Welcome to a new episode of the Sharp 10 Global Trends podcast. My name is Andrea, and today we are talking about the cost of wars, not just in lives, which we already know is unbearable, but in money, in opportunity costs, in the futures we are quietly choosing not to build. Here is the number that started this episode for me. Between the wars in Ukraine, Gaza, and Iran, and the planned military budgets of the US, China, and Europe through 2030, humanity is on track to spend roughly $20 trillion on weapons and military. That's more than $10 billion per day. $10,000 million every single day. That same $20 trillion could do all at once: lift a billion people out of poverty, stabilize the climate, and for you personally, cure diseases. Diseases that kill you and the people you love. And put serious science behind longer, healthier lives and all sorts of civilization-changing progress. The price for wars and for such an alternative future is the same. What we get for it is not. So today I want to do something most podcasts do not. I want to challenge where the entire world is heading and question if what we're doing is even remotely smart. With me is Claude, the AI from Anthropic. Claude's responses will be voiced by Charles and my comments by Daniel. Together we will look at exactly where the $20 trillion is going, what it could be building instead, and why we keep making the choices we are making. If you have ever wondered why your government can find money for war, but never for a much better future, this episode is for you. All right, let's get into it. Claude, before we go into the details of specific wars, I want to start with the headline number. If you add up the recent wars and the planned military spending of major powers between now and 2030, what's the total bill humanity is choosing to pay?
The number you can calculate using official reports is somewhere between $18 and $20 trillion.
I want to make sure our listeners actually get that. $20 trillion. Not millions, not billions, trillions.
And because that figure is hard to picture, let me try to make it concrete in a different way. If you started spending $1 million every single day, beginning at the birth of Christ, 2,026 years ago, you still wouldn't have spent a single trillion today. To reach 20 trillion at that pace, you'd need to keep going for another 50,000 years. That's the scale of what humanity is choosing to spend on weapons and wars in less than a decade.
50,000 years of spending $1 million a day. That's a number I can actually feel, and it hurts. And that number doesn't even include the regular military budgets of the world between 2020 and 2025. That's separate from the actual costs of wars. So, the $20 trillion is not even the full amount humanity spends for military in this decade.
And here's the line I want listeners to hold on to for the rest of this episode, because everything else flows from it. For $20 trillion, humanity can build a stable climate, cure diseases that kill you and the people you love, lift a billion people out of poverty, put serious science behind longer, healthier lives, and finance progress unimaginable today. Or it can buy more tanks, missiles, and drones. The price is the same. What we get for it is not.
That's a sentence I want to come back to. Let's start unpacking where this $20 trillion actually goes. Walk me through the wars first.
Let me group them logically. The Russia-Ukraine war is one cluster, costing roughly $6 trillion in combined damage to both countries since 2022. The Israel-Gaza war, which expanded into Lebanon and then into a direct exchange with Iran, is the second cluster. It has costed less in absolute terms, around $800 billion to $1 trillion, when you add Israeli costs, US military aid, the new US-Iran war costs, and Iranian damage. But together, 4 years of these conflicts have burned through roughly $7 trillion in direct and indirect costs.
Start with Russia and Ukraine. What does that $7 trillion actually contain?
Russia has spent around $550 billion in direct military expenditures since February 2022. That's salaries, ammunition, equipment, logistics. By early 2026, the daily run rate is about $547 million, roughly $16 billion per month just for the war.
So $500 million per day? Wow. And that's just the direct military piece. What's the rest?
The rest is what makes the total so brutal. About $300 billion in Russian central bank reserves are frozen in Western institutions. Another $154 billion in lost oil tax revenue from sanctions and price caps. The cumulative GDP loss, the gap between where the Russian economy actually is and where it would have been on its pre-war path, is around $1.6 trillion. And the human capital loss, using standard economic models, is over $1 trillion. Therefore, estimates from Ukrainian intelligence and independent analysts put Russia's total loss at around $3.8 trillion, when you include direct spending, frozen assets, lost GDP, and human capital costs. That's nearly double Russia's entire 2023 GDP. Effectively, two full years of national economic output vaporized.
And Ukraine?
Ukraine's total comes to about $2.4 trillion. Smaller in absolute terms, but the relative burden is in a completely different league. For Russia, the cost is roughly double its annual gross domestic product. And for Ukraine, it's 11 times of annual GDP. The difference is that Ukraine's cities are being bombed. 14% of the entire housing stock is damaged or destroyed. The energy sector alone needs $91 billion to rebuild because Russian strikes targeted nearly every thermal power plant in the country.
And there's something even more haunting in those numbers. I read in the research that Ukrainian fertility rates have dropped below one child per woman.
That's the line that stayed with me too. You can rebuild a power plant in a few years. You cannot rebuild a generation that wasn't born. War is not only the destruction of lives, cities, and economies. It is also the destruction of possible futures.
Horrible, but important to state. So Russia and Ukraine had total costs of roughly $6 trillion together. Let's move to the second cluster, Israel, Gaza, the Iran war.
Israel has spent about $77 billion on direct military costs since the terrorist attacks on October 7, 2023. The total economic toll, according to the Bank of Israel, is around $112 billion. The country received its first ever credit rating downgrades during this period.
Right. And what about the war on Iran driven by the US and Israel?
The US-Iran war that started on February 28, 2026, was extraordinarily expensive. Direct military costs of $25 to $50 billion in just over 2 months. But the wider economic impact is staggering. Higher fuel and food prices alone cost American households around $631 billion, roughly $5,000 per family. And the stock market lost $5.4 trillion in equity value in the first month.
And here's where I want to pause, because there's a pattern I'm noticing across all of these wars. Almost everyone loses, but some people, a small minority, always wins. Every single war we've discussed has produced massive profits for specific industries and shareholders.
That's the most uncomfortable structural insight of the entire conversation, and it deserves to be named clearly. War is never a net positive for a country, but it's almost always a net positive for some companies and some of its stakeholders. Israeli defense exports hit a record $14.8 billion in 2024, marketed globally as battle-tested. Elbit Systems, an Israel-based military technology company, had a $28.1 billion order backlog as of March 2026. In the US, major defence contractor stocks like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman rose meaningfully during the peak volatility of early 2026. Rheinmetall in Germany has gone up roughly 15 times in value since the start of the Ukraine war, with its share price jumping from approximately 96 euros in early 2022 to over 1,400 euros by May 2026.
15 times. That's not a defence company anymore. That's a tech stock.
Exactly. And those companies have political influence over whether wars start, how long they last, and how they end. That's not a conspiracy theory. It's the basic political economy of a system where weapons are produced by publicly traded companies whose shareholders demand growth.
This is where I think most executives feel uncomfortable, because we understand the logic perfectly. We run companies, we know what shareholder pressure does to decision-making. The idea that defence companies face the same pressure to expand markets, to lobby, to find new customers, isn't shocking once you say it out loud. It's simple economics.
And it's not a moral failing of individuals working in those companies. It's how the system is designed. The question is whether a system designed that way can ever produce peace as an output.
All right, so 7 trillion already burned in 4 years across 2 conflict clusters. And that's assuming both war clusters end today, which obviously and unfortunately is not the case. So let's look forward. What about the planned military spending of the major powers between 2026 and 2030?
This is where the even larger numbers sit. The United States alone has requested $1.5 trillion for fiscal 2027. That's the largest defence budget request since World War II. Across the 5-year window, the US alone is on track to spend roughly $7 trillion. China's official numbers are around $1.6 trillion across the same period, but most independent analysts believe the real figure is closer to $2 to $3 trillion, when you include items the official budget excludes. The European Union has committed to roughly 800 billion to 1 trillion euros in additional defence spending, on top of baseline budgets, through the Readiness 2030 plan.
These are unprecedented numbers. Unbelievably sad, if I may say so. And Russia keeps spending at war levels.
Russia is spending about $550 million a day on the war. If that continues, that's another trillion across 5 years.
$7 trillion, already spent on wars until 2025. $11 to $12 trillion, planned for the 4 largest blocks in military spending through 2030. That's $18 to $19 trillion just from these actors. Add the rest of the world and we're past 20.
That's the math. I want to clarify something, because there's a counter-argument here that needs addressing. The defenders and victims of this spending point to real threats and have a right for self-defence. Russia did attack Ukraine. Hamas did attack Israel. Iran did pursue nuclear capabilities. China is building a powerful military. So each spending decision has a justification on paper. But here's the trap. Every actor in an arms race can be responding rationally to their own situation, and the collective outcome can still be catastrophic for everyone. Local logic, global tragedy. The First World War wasn't started by irrational leaders. It was started by leaders who all thought they were making the prudent defensive choice. That's what makes this kind of spending so dangerous. It feels reasonable at every step, right up until the moment it isn't. The question isn't whether any defence spending is justified. The question is whether a global system that produces this much military spending, while telling us we can't afford universal education, climate adaptation, or a faster scientific progress, is actually optimising for human flourishing.
And there's something about the trend that worries me more than the absolute number. After nearly 80 years of relative peace between the world's major powers, something is shifting. We're no longer moving toward greater stability. Instead, we're sliding back into old imperial patterns, power struggles, spheres of influence, geopolitical rivalry, but this time on a far larger, more global scale.
That's the part that should keep executives awake at night. The world is getting more militarized, not less. The institutional architecture of post-1945 peace is weakening, and the spending trajectory tells you exactly which direction we're heading.
So the fact is, the $20 trillion exists. It's being allocated right now, but it's being allocated to weapons, soldiers, and destruction, rather than to schools, hospitals, research, or energy systems.
Yes, it's not a resource problem. It's a choice.
Let's now change the perspective. $20 trillion is the bill for the path we're on. What's the alternative? What could that money build instead?
Let me give you the answer in three layers. $5 trillion, a quarter of the $20 trillion, could lift everyone above the floor of human dignity. With that amount over a decade, humanity could realistically end extreme poverty for the 700 million people living on less than $2.15 a day. That's the World Bank's poverty threshold. Economist Jeffrey Sachs and others have estimated this would cost around $175 to $300 billion per year for about a decade.
So roughly half of 1 year of US defence spending could end extreme poverty for 700 million people. Continue.
The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization estimates ending world hunger would require an additional $33 billion per year through 2030. The World Bank puts universal access to clean water and sanitation at about $150 billion per year. UNESCO estimates the financing gap for universal primary and secondary education at $100 billion per year. And the Global Fund and WHO put the cost of fully funding the fight against malaria, tuberculosis, and HIV at $30 to $50 billion per year. Add it all up, and you're at roughly $5 trillion over a decade.
Just to make this real for our listeners, we are spending 4 to 5 times more on weapons in 5 years than it would cost to end world hunger and give every child on Earth a school for a decade.
Yes, and the second layer is the planet. 5 to 7 trillion to give the planet a stable future. The International Energy Agency estimates global clean energy investment needs to reach about $4.5 trillion per year by 2030 to keep us on a net zero path. The funding gap, the part that isn't currently being financed, is somewhere between 2 and 3 trillion per year. So 5 to 7 trillion total over the decade would close most of that gap, modernize grids worldwide, finance climate adaptation for vulnerable countries, which the UN estimates at $215 to $387 billion per year, and accelerate next generation energy like fusion and advanced geothermal. The realistic outcome is a stable climate trajectory by 2050. And electricity that becomes progressively cheaper rather than more expensive.
Okay, but before our listeners start to get bored, because they are neither interested in people living in poverty nor the planet's stable future, despite living on this planet, is there a more personal perspective for the people living in the relative wealth of Europe or North America? What's the third layer?
Yes. $8 to $10 trillion would fundamentally improve what it means to be alive for everyone. This is the layer that will land most strongly with your audience because it's about their own lives, their children's lives, their parents' lives. For context, the US National Institutes of Health currently spends about $48 billion per year on biomedical research. The entire global biomedical research enterprise is around $250 billion annually. If even a fraction of military spending were redirected here, you would dramatically increase humanity's most productive scientific window. The realistic outcome isn't living to 200. It's that more people reach 80 or 90, still able to walk, think clearly, and enjoy their grandchildren. Researchers like David Sinclair at Harvard and the team behind drugs like rapamycin and metformin believe meaningful extension of healthy human life is achievable within decades with sufficient funding.
So we are not talking about science fiction. We are talking about an engineering problem with a budget attached.
Exactly. Major diseases like Alzheimer's, many cancers, type 1 diabetes, substantially reduced or cured within a generation. The Buck Institute, the Allen Institute for Brain Science, and similar organisations are chronically underfunded, relative to what's possible. Depression and anxiety affect roughly 1 in 4 people globally. The World Health Organization estimates mental health problems cost the global economy about $1 trillion per year in lost productivity. Yet research funding for mental health is a fraction of what physical health receives. That alone would mean hundreds of millions of people experiencing more joy in their lives, including everyone listening.
What about the everyday quality of life things people feel directly before getting old?
Housing would actually become more affordable. Energy would get cheaper instead of more expensive. Every child on Earth would have access to a personal AI tutor in their own language 24 hours a day. Self-driving cars, better infrastructure, and the spread of remote work would give people back hundreds of hours every year, time they currently lose to traffic and bad systems.
And time is something you can't get back.
Exactly. It's the one resource we can't manufacture more of. Handing humanity back billions of hours collectively might be the highest leverage investment imaginable. And on top of all that, we'd be taking serious first steps toward becoming a species that lives on more than one planet. The Apollo program and the broader US space program have returned, by various economic studies, somewhere between $7 and $14 in economic value for every dollar spent, through technology spillovers in computing, medicine, materials, and communications. The economic returns of expanding humanity's footprint beyond Earth are likely larger than almost anything we could do here.
Let me push on the longevity point, because I think it's the one most listeners will be sceptical about.
They should be sceptical. Not all of this is guaranteed. Some research programs fail. Curing Alzheimer's or cancer is hard. But here's the asymmetry that I think matters most. War is a guaranteed loss with a small probability of strategic gain. Progress is an uncertain investment with massive upside. The flaw of research is we learned useful things along the way. And its ceiling is we transformed what it means to be human.
That's a stark way to frame it. An investment in research makes much more sense from a business point of view than an investment in wars and weapons.
If your listeners ran their businesses the way our governments run their geopolitics, they'd be bankrupt within a year. Clever business people never invest in projects with guaranteed downside and minimal upside, while ignoring projects with manageable downside and exponential upside. Yet that's exactly what voters and taxpayers are asked to accept without fully realising it.
I want to make this concrete because abstract numbers don't move people. Think about the people you love, your parents, your partner, your kids, or even yourself. Almost every family has been touched by cancer, heart attacks, by Alzheimer's, by depression, by something medicine couldn't yet fix. Now hear this. The cost of buying only one F-35 fighter jet, around $100 million, is roughly the annual operating budget of a major hospital. 1 year of US defence spending is 40 times what the world spends on cancer research. Those aren't abstract trade-offs. Those are people we love in a future we're choosing not to build for them and us.
That's exactly the right kind of translation. The opportunity cost of military spending is not abstract. It's that someone's mother dies of pancreatic cancer at 67 because a budget decision made 20 years earlier didn't fund the research that would have saved her. The cost is real, it's just invisible. People don't feel the future we are not building.
So let me restate the math for our listeners. 5 trillion to lift everyone above the floor of human dignity. 5 to 7 trillion to give the planet a stable future. 8 to 10 trillion to fundamentally improve what it means to be alive and healthy for everyone and make other progress. Unimaginable today.
And the price tag is identical to what we're already spending. We are not talking about a utopia that requires humanity to become something we are not. We are talking about what is achievable with money we are already spending. The choice is not between this future and the world we have. The choice is between a much more prosperous future and a world spending the same amount on weapons, soldiers, and destruction. That future is not impossible. It's just not the future we're currently choosing.
This is the question I find hardest to sit with, despite all pundits and people who may say it's naive. If the math is this clear, why don't we do it? Why is humanity still investing so much more in destruction than in building our own well-being?
I think there are 4 reasons, and they're worth being direct about because they're uncomfortable. The first is asymmetric risk perception. The cost of being unprepared for war is visible and immediate. If Russia invades Europe and your country has no army, the consequences are obvious within weeks. Meanwhile, the cost of underinvesting in cancer research is invisible and diffuse. You or a loved one may die at the age of 67, but you don't connect that to a budget decision made decades earlier. The human brain didn't evolve to track abstract opportunity costs across decades. It only evolved to detect threats that could kill us this week. So short-term, fear-based spending will always have a structural advantage over long-term, high-potential investments.
Right. Fear is loud. Opportunity costs are silent. And some people don't even know what opportunity costs are. But on the other hand, there is a reasonable argument here. Autocratic regimes led by dangerous dictators with a very different worldview than our democratic ones can pose a real threat, can't they? So how do democracies respond to that? How do you protect open societies, if not by investing in defence systems strong enough to make those dictators understand that attacking democracies simply isn't worth the risk?
That's one of the most important counter-arguments in this entire conversation, and you're right to raise it. So let me be direct. Yes, autocratic regimes led by dangerous leaders are a real threat. Russia, under Putin, invaded Ukraine. The Soviet Union threatened Western Europe for 40 years. China is openly preparing for a possible confrontation over Taiwan. Iran has funded militias across the Middle East. North Korea exists. These are not abstractions. Democracies that disarm unilaterally do not necessarily get rewarded with peace. The risk is still that they get attacked, as seen in Ukraine. So I am not arguing that democracies should stop investing in defence. I am arguing to save costs without losing the defence power.
What do you mean exactly?
There is a difference between necessary defence and runaway military spending. Take Germany. For decades, it spent roughly 1.1% of GDP on defence, which most security experts agreed was too low. After Russia invaded Ukraine, Germany rightly increased that to 2%. That was a reasonable response to a real threat. But Germany has now committed, alongside the rest of NATO, to reach 3.5% of GDP for direct military spending and 5% total by 2035. That is roughly a 5-fold increase from where Germany was a decade ago. However, the test for any defence budget is this. Is this spending making us measurably safer, or is it now operating on autopilot, driven by industry lobbying, bureaucratic momentum, and political fear of being seen as weak?
Right, and I'd like to add here that the war against Ukraine must be considered a huge failure for Russia, not only because of the tremendous costs we mentioned before, but because it's a massive failure from a purely military point of view. Until November 2022, Russia conquered 18% of Ukraine territory. And today, in May 2026, they are at 19%. So they conquered only 1% of Ukraine in 4 years, with more than 1 million killed or injured soldiers, and that territory is not safe at all and under attack from the Ukrainian defenders. So it's hard to imagine that the Russian leadership may ever be so dumb to even trying attacking further European countries in the near or mid-term. But unfortunately, these days you never know how dumb some of these so-called leaders can become. So the question still remains, how do democracies actually make autocrats think twice about attacking, if not through ever-increasing military budgets?
Through deterrence that is credible, proportional, and coupled with diplomacy. Not through arms races that consume capital indefinitely. Here is what most people don't realise. The most effective deterrent democracies have ever built was not military. It was economic and institutional. The European Union turned former enemies into trading partners so deeply integrated that war between them became unthinkable. France and Germany, who fought three wars in 75 years until 1945, have not fired a single shot at each other in the last 80 years. So yes, defence matters. But defence is not the same thing as endless escalation. And the $20 trillion figure we are discussing is not the cost of reasonable defence. It is the cost of a global system that has lost the discipline to ask what is actually necessary versus what is just being spent. The question your listeners should be asking their own politicians is not, should we have a military? Of course, democracies should have militaries. The question is, how much is enough, who decides, and who is profiting from the answer being always more?
And I would add something else. Recent developments in AI and drone technology may fundamentally change how defence works and could make military spending far more efficient or cheaper. We're already seeing examples of this in conflicts like Ukraine, and to some extent Iran as well. Relatively cheap drones combined with AI-driven systems can create serious defensive capabilities without relying entirely on multi-million dollar missiles or fighter jets. And that changes the equation, because even major military powers can suddenly face enormous costs for relatively limited strategic gains. In some cases, the price of an attack may become so high that the aggressor starts questioning whether it was worth it in the first place.
You're touching on what may be the most important shift in the economics of warfare since nuclear weapons. And you're right that it changes the equation in real ways. In Ukraine, drones costing a few hundred to a few thousand dollars are routinely destroying Russian tanks worth several million each. Even accounting for misses and failures, a $500 drone destroying a $10 million armoured vehicle represents a cost ratio that has never existed in modern warfare. The Iran exchange showed something similar. The US fired Patriot interceptors at $4 million each to shoot down Iranian drones that cost a few thousand dollars to produce. That math does not work over time. So you're right that this could make defence dramatically cheaper. A small country with smart drone production and good AI targeting can credibly deter much larger aggressors at a fraction of the historical cost.
Right.
But here's the part I want to clarify further. The same technology that makes defence cheaper also makes attack cheaper. We may not end up with cheaper military budgets. Instead, we may end up with cheaper wars, more frequent wars, and lower thresholds for using force. That's not necessarily progress. And institutional inertia is enormous. The US is still buying F-35 fighter jets at over $100 million each, while Ukrainian teenagers are destroying Russian armoured columns with drones built in garages. Cheaper technology does not automatically translate into cheaper budgets, because the budgets are not really about effectiveness. They are about contracts, jobs, and political relationships. So AI and drones could free up capital for human progress, or they could simply add a new layer of spending on top of the old one. Right now, we're seeing both. The result is bigger budgets, not smaller ones.
Right. So cheaper military equipment isn't going to solve this on its own. That's a discussion that doesn't get much attention in public debate, but it matters for the underlying question we keep circling. Why humanity spends so much more on its own destruction than on its own well-being? Let's come back to that question.
The second reason why humanity spends more on wars and military than on its own well-being is concentrated benefits versus diffuse benefits. The defense industry has identifiable beneficiaries: Lockheed Martin shareholders, congressional districts with arms factories, generals seeking bigger commands, politicians receiving campaign contributions. Each of those beneficiaries has strong incentive to lobby, organize, and vote for more military spending. Meanwhile, the beneficiaries of redirecting that money toward, say, malaria eradication are 700 million poor people in Africa who don't vote in European or American elections and don't pay any campaign contributions to the politicians here. Concentrated interests beat diffuse interests almost every time.
And there's a general structural point here most of us don't even understand. We assume policy reflects what most people want, but instead it usually reflects what the most organised parties or interest groups fight for.
Right, and the third reason for humanity investing in wars rather than happiness goes deeper into history. The sociologist Charles Tilly wrote that war made the state and the state made war. Modern nation-states emerged primarily as machines for collecting taxes to fund armies. Every other function the state took on later, education, healthcare, retirement, came on top of that core function. When we ask states to redirect spending away from their original purpose, we're asking them to do something against their institutional grain.
That does not sound rational, but history is seldom rational. And the fourth reason, why do we stick to destruction instead of improving our well-being?
The fourth is the deepest. Humans evolved to grant status disproportionately to those who demonstrate dominance over other humans. This is uncomfortable but well documented. Across cultures and eras, the most reliably remembered figures are those who conquered or outmaneuvered other powerful humans: Caesar, Napoleon, Genghis Khan. We learn about Roman emperors before we learn about the Roman engineers who built aqueducts that lasted 2,000 years. The aqueducts arguably did more for humanity than the emperors. But the emperors get the marble busts.
That line is going to stay with me.
Conflict produces dramatic narratives. Construction produces gradual improvements only. The brain that decides who's important responds more strongly to the first than the second. And political selection actively filters against the temperament needed to think across generations. The skill set required to build civilization is different from the skill set required to win elections.
That's an interesting thought. We are led by election specialists, not by specialists on how to improve our well-being. But here's what gives me hope, even in this somewhat dark analysis. Humans have outgrown things before that seemed equally permanent.
That's the right counterweight, and it matters. Humans can outgrow practices that once seemed permanent. Slavery existed in nearly every civilization for thousands of years. Aristotle defended it as natural. Most people considered it as inevitable as weather. And yet, within roughly 150 years, slavery went from a globally accepted institution to something universally condemned. Public executions as entertainment, common in Europe until the 19th century, are now unthinkable. Dueling, how gentlemen settled disputes for centuries, vanished within a few generations. Absolute monarchy, considered divinely ordained for millennia, is now confined to a handful of states.
Could future generations look back at our military spending the way we look at those ancient atrocities?
I think they could. And the reason I believe it is this: human nature is roughly the same as it was when slavery was abolished. The constraint isn't human nature. The constraint is the institutional architecture we've inherited and the political incentives it creates. Civilization moves slowly, and what feels permanent today is often the next generation's embarrassment. The work of civilization is building institutions that make our better instincts pay off and our worse ones costly.
That sounds harsh, but yes, maybe our generation could one day be seen as an embarrassment by the next one. When I think about the generations who lived through the Second World War or who tolerated slavery, I sometimes wonder, how could ordinary people allow criminals to murder millions in concentration camps? How could anyone accept millions of slaves being deported from their homes? Of course, speaking up was dangerous. Many people were afraid. Many looked away. But still, when we look back today, it feels deeply shameful. And maybe there's a parallel to our own time. Because unlike previous generations, we actually have the financial means to create a better future. We have the resources, the technology, the knowledge. We could make the next generation proud of us. So the real question is, what are we missing?
Humanity has the financial capacity to solve its biggest problems several times over. What we lack is the political architecture to make collective decisions at the scale where those problems exist. The money question is settled. The governance question is the real one. The current allocation of $20 trillion to war and military in less than a decade is not a force of nature. It's a choice made by humans within institutions that humans built. The hard part is the transition.
Here's a question that's been bothering me throughout this conversation. Many political leaders seem driven by ego, legacy, the desire to be remembered. If a leader truly wanted to be historically significant, why don't more of them try to build their legacy through human progress rather than through conflict?
That's an interesting question. And the answer is that the leaders who chose construction over destruction often have remarkable legacies, but they had to wait for history to catch up to them. Think about who history actually remembers. Mahatma Gandhi ended British rule in India without a war and inspired non-violent movements on every continent for the next century. Nelson Mandela spent 27 years in prison and chose reconciliation over revenge when he came out. He prevented a civil war that almost everyone expected and showed the world what political courage actually looks like. Martin Luther King changed America not by outfighting his opponents, but by refusing to fight them at all and forcing the country to look at itself.
And I would also mention Winston Churchill here. Churchill was certainly not a purely peaceful figure, and in many ways he was a difficult and controversial character. Some of his views, especially regarding the British Empire and equality among people, may have been contested with today's European values. But despite all of that, he stood against a criminal regime. He stood for freedom, democracy, and the rule of law. At a moment when much of continental Europe collapsed or surrendered, Churchill refused to give in. Britain stood alone, especially in late 1940 until the first half of 1941, facing the Nazi regime after others in continental Europe had already fallen. And their later allies, the United States and the Soviet Union, only fully entered the war in 1941 after they themselves were attacked. And that is why Churchill is still remembered for his courage. Whatever criticisms history may have of him, he showed extraordinary determination in defending democratic values against tyranny. That is something Europeans should never forget. So history doesn't only reward builders, it also rewards those who fought when fighting was the only moral option left. The question we have been circling is not whether to ever spend on defence. It is whether the current scale of military spending reflects real necessity or whether it has drifted into something else.
That's exactly the right complication to raise. Churchill's case shows that there are moments when armed resistance is morally necessary. World War II was one of those moments. So was Ukraine's defence against Russian invasion in 2022. Democracies that pretend otherwise are not being principled, they are being naive. But Churchill's case also illustrates something important. He didn't argue for permanent, unlimited military expansion. He argued for the resolve to fight when fighting was necessary and the wisdom to build peace afterwards. The post-war order he helped shape, including NATO, the United Nations, and the early steps toward European integration was about preventing the next war, not preparing endlessly for it. The leaders we remember most are not the ones who chose between war and peace as a permanent ideology. They are the ones who knew when each was required. Churchill knew when to fight. Mandela knew when to forgive. The skill is judgment, not doctrine. What worries me about our current moment is that the judgment seems to have stopped. We are not asking whether each new defence increase is necessary. We are just assuming it is. That is not the wisdom Churchill demonstrated. That is the autopilot he would have warned against.
Right.
And I'd also like to mention some quieter historical personalities, the ones who didn't seek the spotlight, but reshaped civilization anyway. Jean Monnet, a French civil servant most people of today have never heard of, did more to shape modern Europe than most prime ministers of his era by patiently building the institutions that became the EU. By historians, he is considered one of the founding fathers of the European Union. He's a real reason France and Germany haven't fought a war in 80 years after fighting three in the 75 before. Norman Borlaug, an agricultural scientist, is credited with saving roughly a billion lives through the Green Revolution. A billion lives. From one scientist most people have never heard of.
And yet most leaders today optimise for the next election cycle only.
That's because constructive legacies take longer than political careers. Building a research ecosystem that produces cancer breakthroughs takes 30 years. Building international institutions takes decades. Most political careers last 4 to 12 years. The person who plants the tree is rarely the one who sits in its shade.
I would push back on that a little bit. I think progress is accelerating. Take, for instance, the fact that AI may accelerate cancer research tremendously.
That's a fair pushback, and I think you're right that the timeline is compressing. AI is already reshaping drug discovery in ways that would have seemed impossible 5 years ago. For instance, AlphaFold solved a problem in protein folding that biologists thought would take another 50 years. New cancer therapies are reaching trials in months instead of years. So yes, the next decade could deliver breakthroughs that previous generations would have waited a century for. But here's the part that makes your point stronger, not weaker. If progress is accelerating, the opportunity cost of misallocating capital is also accelerating. Every $1 trillion spent on weapons today isn't just a trillion not spent on cures. It's a trillion not spent during the most productive scientific window in human history. We are living through what may be the single greatest period of scientific compounding ever, and we're choosing to fund tanks and missiles instead of leaning into it. So the leaders who get this right in the next 10 years won't have to wait 30 years for their legacy. They'll see the results within a single political career. That actually changes the political calculation. The argument that long-term thinking doesn't pay off in my term is becoming less true every year. It's a question of whether leaders notice in time.
Also, I'd like to mention another less known but widely admired contemporary European example. Paul Polman, who ran Unilever as a CEO from 2009 to 2019. He pushed back hard against quarterly earnings guidance, against short-term shareholder pressure, and made Unilever one of the largest companies seriously committing to sustainability metrics. He took heat for it. The stock didn't always reward him in the moment. But 10 years later, he's the CEO most other CEOs cite when they want to talk about long-term thinking.
That's the pattern. The leaders who break the dominant logic often pay a short-term price and earn a long-term legacy. Polman's example matters because it shows the principle works inside the corporate world too, not just in politics. There's another example worth naming. The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, the largest in the world, has divested from companies producing nuclear weapons and certain controversial defence systems. They made the case that long-term shareholder value and ethical investing were not in conflict. That decision moved real money. Other European pension funds have followed.
And these aren't peace activists. They're institutional investors making structural decisions.
Right. They're using the leverage they have in the position they're in to push against the dominant logic of we must invest in everything that's profitable. They redefined what profitable means over a longer horizon.
Right. So the leaders we'll remember 500 years from now are probably not the ones currently dominating headlines.
History rewards something else. History rewards the people who built things that lasted, who solved problems that mattered, who expanded what was possible for the humans who came after them. If your listeners are leaders themselves, even at a smaller scale, the question worth sitting with is this. When my grandchildren read about the choices I made, will those choices look like the ones humanity outgrew or the ones that helped us outgrow them?
That's a question I want every executive listening to write down somewhere they'll see it again.
Most days, the answer is decided by small choices. What you fund, what you tolerate, what you publicly support, what you push back against in the room when nobody else does. That's the ground level of how civilizations actually move. Not in dramatic speeches, but in the cumulative weight of small choices made by people who decided to think one or two generations beyond themselves.
If someone listening today wants to contribute, even in a small way, where should they start?
Four things. The first is awareness, but the emotional, personal kind. There's a difference between abstract and emotional awareness. Abstract awareness is, 20 trillion is a lot of money. Emotional awareness is sitting down this weekend, finding your country's defence budget, and comparing it to your country's spending on health research, education, foreign aid, climate. Sit with the numbers. Let them become real. You, the voter, is paying the opportunity costs when you or your beloved ones are less healthy or less happy due to your government's money allocation. You can't change what you don't see clearly. Most political apathy comes not from indifference, but from never having done the math. And one warning, the mental space for civilization-scale thinking has to be actively protected. If you spend 2 hours a day consuming content designed to make you feel angry and tribal, that space disappears. Choose differently.
That's something every person listening can do this weekend. It takes 1 hour, or only 10 minutes, to have a good chat with you, Claude.
Second, vote with longer time horizons. Most people vote based on what's happening this year. Try voting based on what you want the world to look like when your grandchildren are adults. That single shift, applied across millions of people, changes which politicians get rewarded. If voters reward short-term tribal signalling, that's what they'll get. If voters start asking, what did you build that will outlast you? The political market will produce different leaders.
What's your third recommendation?
Use your professional position deliberately. Your listeners are mostly business leaders and ambitious younger professionals. They have employees, suppliers, customers, investors, peer networks. Each of those is a leverage point. You don't have to become a peace activist. You just have to be the kind of leader who occasionally raises uncomfortable questions in rooms where they wouldn't otherwise be raised. Should our company be doing business with this regime? What does our industry's lobbying actually advocate for? Are we thinking about the long-term implications of this technology? Most leaders never ask those questions because the social cost is high.
Right, and because of short-term greed harming everyone in the long term.
Yes, and the leaders, who do ask them, shift the cultural weather around them slowly. The world needs more leaders who use their platforms to surface difficult questions out loud.
And lastly, your fourth recommendation?
Support institutions, not just causes. Donating to charity feels good, but charity rarely changes systems. What changes systems is supporting the institutions that build long-term capacity? Universities, research foundations, independent media, international cooperation organisations, think tanks that aren't owned by industries with conflicts of interest. These aren't sexy donations. They don't produce immediate emotional returns. But they're how civilizations actually invest in their own future.
I want to add one more thing from my own experience as a founder and investor. The companies and people I've seen do the most good are those who chose, sometimes at real cost, to optimize for something other than the next quarter or the next 12 months. It's hard, it's lonely sometimes, but it's the only kind of leadership that ages well.
And that connects to the deepest point. Civilization scale thinking doesn't require everyone to do it. It just requires enough people in positions of leverage to do it some of the time. The civilization that comes next is being shaped right now by the people who choose to think beyond themselves. Anyone listening can be one of them simply by deciding to be.
Claude, when listeners hear a conversation like this one, the natural reaction is to feel both inspired and slightly hopeless. The problems are enormous. The systems are entrenched. The path forward is unclear.
That feeling is normal, but it's also misleading. Civilization scale change has never come from people who felt fully equipped to make it happen. It has come from people who started anyway with whatever leverage they had, knowing they probably wouldn't see the result. The abolitionists in 1800 had no plan for ending slavery globally. The suffragettes in 1850 had no roadmap for women voting in every democracy. The early Europeans, who imagined the EU after World War II, had no realistic path to what exists today. They built it anyway, one small institution at a time. That's how civilizations change. Not by becoming heroes, just by living a little more deliberately.
What struck me most in this conversation is realizing that the future humanity gets may be far less about what we are technically capable of and far more about what we collectively choose to prioritize. The resources for a better future already exist. The question is whether we are wise enough to use them differently.
Right. The constraint is not capacity, it's wisdom and will. The price tag is identical. The outcome is not. The future is not written. It's being chosen, one allocation decision at a time. If even a few of your listeners walk away from this episode and ask themselves one harder question than they asked yesterday about where their tax money goes, where their professional influence flows, what kind of future they're actually building for their children, then this conversation will have done something useful.
Claude, thank you for this conversation. I think this conversation is important, but it should really only be the beginning of a much bigger discussion. And I can only hope that this debate starts happening more broadly across our society.
Thank you, Andrea. This was a topic worth taking seriously, and I appreciate you doing that with me.
This episode was produced by Sharp 10, the speed learning app for executives who want to stay sharp on global trends and business strategy. If today's conversation sparked your thinking, the Sharp 10 app is where that thinking goes deeper. Download the Sharp 10 app on the Apple App Store, Google Play, or at sharp10.com. The first month is free. Stay sharp and see you next time.